the Divided Kingdom news program coming to you on WWCR and Liberty Works Radio Network. We've just had a momentous election. You win some, you lose some. Conservatives and Christians are cheering. The Republicans took the U.S. Senate in these formidably important midterm elections. Yet they have to lament the loss of the House. Of course, that means we'll have Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. We've all heard many sound clips delineating how radical left ideas and pronouncements, or her radical left ideas and pronouncements. Yet Elizabeth Cuppert Cavalli and I, Lou Cavalli, remember a tiny seed of hope, a little mustard seed from the George W. Bush years. A surprising friendship at the onset and during the horrible yellow cake flying Iraq war, Nancy Pelosi had a close friendship with John P. Murther, congressman from western Pennsylvania. Elizabeth Cavalli's childhood scene. In fact, Elizabeth was born in Winbur, Pennsylvania, a coal mining town on the outskirts of Johnstown. John P. Murther was highly thought of in that region near Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Yes, Lou, I will remember the dramatic radio interview in which the late Dr. Stan Monteith spoke with Murtha, and how valiantly and passionately John Murtha defended not getting the U.S. into the developing Iraq war's coming quagmire.
There is good and evil in each of us. Listeners, something to pray for, that President Trump will be able to help Nancy Pelosi become a bipartisan and help in making America great again.
Yes, we hope that that might happen, because President Trump has apparently reached the mind and heart of Senator Lindsey Graham.
Yes, I've heard that, and that's no small feat. Love of national sovereignty is on the rise worldwide. The Trumpian sparks have set off a love of liberty. We're going to take a look at some of the key men involved just as Angela Merkel prepares to step down in December. First, some excerpts from Time Magazine's November 12, 2018 issue. Writer Matt Sandy in Rio de Janeiro tells us about, quote, Brazil's shock to the system. President-elect Bolsonaro swept in from the far right, unquote. The din in Brazil's lower house of Congress was so loud, the seven-term congressman running for speaker could barely be heard. His colleagues paid little attention, many speaking over him. Unperturbed, Jair Messias Bolsonaro forged on, waving a newspaper as he railed against his ineffective contemporaries. The former army captain, then 62, won just four of the 504 votes that day, in February 2017, a result that seemed to confirm his irrelevance in Brazilian politics. Yet an aide was streaming his diatribe live on Facebook, where it received 450,000 views and accelerated his nascent political movement. Just 21 months later, Bolsonaro has the full attention, not only of Brazil, but of a weary world. He was elected president on October 28th with nearly 58 million votes. It was a political earthquake for Latin America's largest nation. The impact of a far-right candidate assuming control of its young democracy rivals the election of Donald Trump to the U.S. or the Brexit vote in Europe. Bolsonaro, initially known mainly for his hateful invective at women, gays, and racial minorities, wrote a storm of anger at a deeply corrupt political class, at the country's worst-ever recession, and one of the highest homicide rates on earth. Quote, that chaos was paid for by poor people without resources. Unemployment and violence hit them more, says Rodrigo Constantino, a political commentator. Brazil's elite live in a bubble, he adds. Quote, they interact with the same people, read the same newspapers, eat the same food, go to the same places, and lost touch with the people, unquote. On the campaign trail, Bolsonaro promised to meet violence with greater violence. playing to the fears of a population traumatized by 175 murders a day. He spoke of a future free from the corruption and crime many voters associated with the establishment in general, and specifically his opponent, Fernando Haddad's Workers' Party, which led Brazil for 13 of the past 15 years. Carlo Ferrison, a 45-year-old Bolsonaro campaigner, expressed the anger that many in Brazil felt at the political class. He said, quote, she said, quote, whoever didn't win the elections didn't listen to the streets. The other parties thought they had a monopoly on power and would get what they wanted. How many lifelong politicians weren't elected? This is the result of our work, unquote. The question is what Brazil will look like under a president who has lionized Brazil's 1964-85 dictatorship, when state-sanctioned torture and murder was rife. He told Time in an August interview that he now fully endorses democracy, although he intends to appoint several generals to key ministerial positions. But his pledge did not stop him from threatening his left-wing opponents less than 2 weeks ago with exile or jail. Quote, when facing grave difficulties, our country has repeatedly chosen authoritarianism, says historian Lilia Moritz-Schwartz, the co-author of Brazil, a biography, citing colonialism and slavery as factors that created a patrimonial, highly violent society. And she said, quote, this bet on Bolsonaro now comes as no surprise, unquote. Others doubt Bolsonaro will embrace autocracy now that he has won power by democratic means, said Hiro Nicolo, a political scientist at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, quote, we have strong institutions with strong communications, an active civil society, and a military that is neutral and distant from politics. This is not a banana republic, unquote. Yet human rights defenders, civil rights groups, and environmentalists fear the direction Brazil will go under its new president. Journalists alone have faced 141 instances of threats of violence. Quote, Bolsonaro said if we don't leave the country, he will throw us in jail, says Diva Santana of Tortura Nunca Mace, a group that is still fighting for justice for those tortured and, quote-unquote, disappeared by the military regime 33 years after it ended. She went on to say, quote, but I'm not leaving. I'm not afraid of him, not a little bit, unquote. Although Bolsonaro has yet to announce a detailed policy blueprint, he pledged to address Brazil's record homicide rate, which hit 63,880 in 2017, by relaxing gun laws and giving police more freedom to kill. That will only make matters worse, says Sylvia Ramos of the Center for Studies of Public Security and Citizenship. Quote, only someone who is in despair would think that introducing more guns, more police brutality, and more incarceration will lead to a reduction in criminality.
And I have to interject there, Lou. We see this same kind of an anti-populist, anti-nationalism coming in the mainstream media. We always have this little slant. Now, it's not clear to us yet whether this new leader in Brazil will be a strong man in the good sense, like Trump, who now, I guess, has said goodbye to Jeff Sessions. Is that correct, Lou?
Yes, that's just breaking news as of today.
Yeah, so we'll see. The one good thing he did, I believe, was to help secure our borders more. So I certainly hope that the new occupant of that office will continue that. But when we hear this idea, the drumbeat of the guns, the anti-gun drumbeat, we always have to be suspicious. And interrupting your article there just a minute, you know, we come from Brazil back to the U.S., and there was sort of an afterglow in the terrible darkness of the shooting in the Pittsburgh Squirrel Hill area synagogue. And so in this afterglow, it was very strange because some of the people who seemed to be the most asleep are Jewish people. Now, I would assume the rise of right-wing terrorism, again, this was a Time magazine, November 12th article, the rise of right-wing terrorism by Daniel Benjamin. To me, that's just about as Jewish-sounding a name as we can get. And these are just a few excerpts. Two major developments appear to be driving the rise in acts of hatred. The first is the creation of an extremist community online. Now, Benjamin comes to the second development that has lit, this is a direct quote, the second development that has lit up this increasingly linked and animated extremist world is Trump. The statistics demonstrate clearly that the biggest bump in hate crimes in recent history coincides with the period since his presidential campaign began. This is not just a matter of correlation. Trump's incendiary rhetoric has given license to those who peddle hatred to emerge from the shadows. Sayoc and Bauer seem clearly unhinged, barely functioning and susceptible to any utterance from the commander-in-chief. Though he was sure to condemn Saturday's attack and the previous week's terrorism, Trump evinces little conviction. He denounces, quote, globalists, not Jews, but anyone with eyes to see recognizes the reference to international Jewry, one made all the more visible by his sly attacks on billionaire George Soros. His reference to his own former staffer Gary Kahn as a globalist, as well as the closing ad of the 2016 campaign, which vilified Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, Fed Chairman Janet Yellen, and Soros, a trinity of Jewish capital, all underscore the case. Now, we see how deceitful the left is because we understand that George Soros himself, on a prior 60 Minutes interview, admitted that he helped as a collaborator to round up his Jewish people, the people who should have been saved by a hero, not rounded up, though he was young at the time, probably a teenager. So how can we link him as one of the devout Jews, one of the Jews who was saved from the Holocaust? You see how the whole picture is getting muddied and how careless these people are with their vitriol. We heard a phrase on WBJC, classical music from Baltimore, and I believe that the announcer was reading from the AAP script, but this was the phrase, a wave of revulsion toward the polarizing president. I don't see a lot of revulsion. You know, you and I went to vote yesterday, and we saw a lot of good-faith people there. Some were African-American. Some elderly white people were there helping with the voting. I didn't see much revulsion or hear much commentary. Did you, of revulsion?
No, I saw none whatsoever. None whatsoever.
None. And, you know, this idea of the guns that we interrupted about the guns, I believe that we have to know something about that, too. Perhaps I don't have an article about that right here, right now. But there was some commentary, again, that we needed more guns. Of course, they had this. And, you know, when we're getting into this right here, we'll come back to this idea of why are the Jewish people being confused, because they don't seem to understand that there is a deep state, New World Order, and of course it has some of what John Kottmeyer, the late head of Liberty Works Radio Network, called the atheistic Jews. Of course it has some Illuminati members who are Jewish, but at the same time, we know there are many devout Jewish people who believe in the Old Testament, and they're part of God's everlasting covenant. He still has a plan with them. And we also know that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of President Trump, has a friendship with Netanyahu. So, you know, it has always been traditional that the Christian church in America has had a love for Israel. And this is definitely biblical. You and I have hunted because we're very disturbed by the anti-Jewish bent of Matt Tiemann's newsletter, the Tribulation newsletter. He has so much other wonderful information, and we'll be bringing some of that to you. There's a lot about the satanic culture of death and eugenics and the hospice movement. Soon we'll bring that some of that to you. But apparently Matt Tiemann believes, like a number of other people, in replacement theology. But you know who tried to replace some of the Bible, and that was Thomas Jefferson. He made his own little Bible, and I would fear for him, even if he was our patriotic genius forebearer, I would fear for his eternal soul, because the Bible tells us, what does it say, Lou, if we change the scripture, delete it?
Says anyone that does that will be accursed.
So I really would not want to be in that particular position. But at any rate, you and I were talking, we do not like this term Zionist Jew affixed to the deep state New World Order people, because truly that word had a good connotation. The Jewish people were seeking a home, Zion. They would go up to Zion in the Bible. So that it's not a good thing to be just using Jews with a kind of a hatred as scapegoats for the whole coalition of the New World Order, which we know includes the royal families, the Vatican, the Bilderbergers. God only knows how many secret societies. And it includes the Marxists. Now, here again, we have to bring up something. When I was looking at this aftershock, I shall say, like the earthquake, the aftershock of Pittsburgh, Squirrel Hill, the shooting, Time Magazine, November 12th, quoted John Meacham. Now, John Meacham is really esteemed in the mainstream historical world. He has written books on some of our forefathers, and he used to write, I believe that he possibly wrote for Newsweek as well, or was the editor there. And he says, when leadership fails, George Washington understood the stakes. As the first of everything, Washington wrote, whatever he did substantially as well as stylistically would, quote, serve to establish a precedent. Now, that sounds good. That sounds really nice. And then, this is a little phrase out of that article in Time. We now know, as surely as anything is knowable in human affairs, that Trump is determined to be a force for division, not for unity. Now, isn't any true historian, Lou, supposed to give evidence for a comment?
Yes, a good historian will back up what he says.
Now, listen to this comment again, this generalization. We now know, as surely as anything is knowable in human affairs, that Trump is determined to be a force for division, not for unity. You know, again, there's a lot of hubris there. Do you feel that you know this political scene, what has happened there in the midterms, as well as anything is knowable in human affairs, Lou?
No, not at all.
Oh, I guess you're one of those humble Christian types.
I guess so.
You know, you and I have lived long enough. We've had the, I can't use the word, beaten out of us in our lifetime, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
We have been battered.
Yep.
We used to joke we were riding the rims because we were poor, we were sick. I went through devastating illnesses, and you went through 7 years of basic joblessness. We had everything shaken up out of us, and the Lord showed us, even after that, he showed me, or in the middle of that, that I was a sinner after all. I never thought I was. I thought I was Miss Goody Two Shoes. I was always in the Sunday school class, and I was always doing things for my mother with her women's groups from the church. I was always the church pianist. I really didn't conceive of myself as the sinner. I was always the one picked on by everyone. And I understand that well now, too. There were, when we talk about vitriol, there were vicious attacks on me starting from the time I was a child. And, you know, I believe it probably started when my mother was breastfeeding me, and she had no realization that because she had been given a drug, I can't remember. Do you remember, Lou? It's something, oh, phenobarbital, that's what it was. And she had no consciousness that this could go into her breast milk. And she said to me, you went out. And I think she meant it was pretty seriously out, because she said, I prayed to the Lord, and I begged him. I begged him. I said, if he would let you live, I would give your life to him. So you see, I think right at that moment, Satan took notice, and he thought, And I'm sure Satan took notice, Lou, when you were there in, was it eighth or ninth grade when the teacher talked to you?
Ninth grade. Yes.
The English teacher took you aside and said, I think you ought to get some help for your speech impediment because you might want to do radio work one day. Now, what kind of little ninth grader is really interested in some comment like that from an old fuddy-duddy teacher? Nobody. But God was interested. So you see, God brought us to this point where we are truth-tellers to the best degree that we are able to. With the limited resources, we were a little bit sad when someone wrote to us. They heard our older program, Hitler and the Occult, and they said, my goodness, the listening quality is so much better. You must have upgraded your equipment. No, we had to give up our Comrex box about 4 years ago because the phone lines changed, and we couldn't use it. But you know what? I said to Lou, which would be better? If we had been able to stay on a network and have the very best of sound quality and never get any letters, never get any response, or have our real true voices on the telephone enhanced with the wonderful quality of Global Star Communications, and we always thank Todd Waite for stepping into the gap, or our program would have been no more. We thank Rick Shelton, too, at WWCR, because he told us that Todd would help us. Those two are great men. We could tell you a lot more about those men, but they have courage, and they really are patriotic Americans. So, you know, I've said to Lou, I think the quality of my voice is better with the telephone because it has a certain edge. It has my true soul more than that sort of an artificially resonant Comrex made me. So, you see, we're telling you that we've had vicious attacks because God wanted us to be watchmen who would tell the truth. And when I say that John Meacham says this with no proof, we now know as surely as anything is knowable in human affairs. Isn't that ludicrous? That Trump is determined to be a force for division, not for unity. He has no apparent interest in rising to the historical moment. But you know what? John Meacham rose to the historical moment some years back when it was Nelson Mandela. Remember that Marxist in South Africa? When it was his birthday, John Meacham took his young son there to meet Mandela and wrote this glowingly wonderful adoration report. I guess we know who the Trojan horses are in the MSM and in our country. Why don't you pick up the rest of the story there about Brazil? And again, we really worry about what's happening in our own hemisphere with Venezuela going into chaos. We hope and pray that this man in Brazil will do good things. He has to be somewhat of a strong man. Go ahead, Lou.
Yes, just to repeat one quote, this lady had said, quote, only someone who is in despair would think that introducing more guns, more police brutality, and more incarceration will lead to a redirection, a reduction in criminality.
Now, again, that's a kind of an emotionally loaded viewpoint. You see,
yes.
Where's the proof that this man is in any kind of despair? And where's the proof on her part that despair is always linked with getting more guns? No, we can turn that right around and say that under Jeff Sessions, we tightened the borders. The border agents who under Obama were not even permitted to do anything. Of course they had to have guns, didn't they, Lou?
Yes, they did.
So you see, these are lies, and we must have the courage to expose them. Continue.
I'll interject, too. I think I would be in despair if I was helpless against a bunch of armed men and they hit guns and I didn't.
Oh, absolutely.
But now to go on with the article, it says, but some who live in Brazil's most crime-ridden urban areas say things can't get much worse. Charlie Lima, 23, who lives in a Rio de Janeiro favela, said revolutionary solutions are called for. He said, quote, we only respect what we fear. Unfortunately, that's the way it works, The country will only change if something radical happens, he said. Dennis Rizzo's economy, which has started with a crippling budgetary deficit and hefty unemployment rates. Bolsonaro has promised to pull Brazil out of crisis by privatizing state companies, pushing through a painful reform of the pension system, and opening Brazil further to foreign investors, moves that won him crucial business support. But the left is likely to resist that, with widespread labor action beginning in January, predicts Jair Luiz Mallard, director of the Instituto Liberal think tank. He said, quote, these won't be easy times for the president and for the country, unquote. That may give Bolsonaro a confrontation he would relish. But it remains to be seen whether the army of enthusiastic supporters he built up over the election would stand by him if he decides to remake Brazil entirely. Polls show most Bolsonaro voters do not actually share his radical views, but wanted to cause a huge upheaval in the political system. On that front, at least, Brazil's new president has already delivered.
And we are taking a look at a couple more figures, you see, who are what we call, quote, nationalists. And that doesn't mean that they hate other races or that they love the white race especially. They love their own countries. And we will interrupt here at this moment to say thank you for a number of letters from you listeners, and thank you for a few contributions, too. And if you can help us stay on the air, you can put a little cash in an envelope, or you can write a check, not to us, we can't take checks, but to WWCR, and you can send it to Lou Caverly, capital L-O-U, capital C-A-V as in victory, E-R-L-Y, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And again, that is Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And we do hope that you will urge some of the people, if you still go to a church, or some of your friends, neighbors, relatives, to go visit our archives. Lou just brought them up to date. And we had some important programs starting with the latter days of September. Go to thedividedkingdom.org. Again, that is thedividedkingdom.org, and you can hear our program. I think we had a very important program last week, too, the tent, about the what's planned with Antifa and so forth. Now, getting back to another figure, and again, this was Time Magazine, September 24th, the most feared man in Europe, Matteo Salvini, Italy's hardline interior minister, wants to remake the EU for nationalists by Vivienne Walt. And I will have several excerpts from this. As evening fell on the town of Alzano, Lombardo, in northern Italy one Sunday, in early September, about 2,000 people crowded into a marquee tent. Anticipation grew as the announcer blared through a loudspeaker over the music, Il Capitano sta arrivando, arrivando. The captain is coming. Il Capitano was Italy's Matteo Salvini, the far-right interior minister, whose rocketing rise over just 6 months has jolted Europe's establishment and threatens to finally upturn a political system that has reeled under a populist surge for the past 3 years. When Salvini finally bursts onto the stage after dark in jeans and his trademark green sneakers, the crowd was spellbound. For nearly 2 hours, a beer in one hand, he told the audience he would seize back control of their lives from the European Union's faceless bureaucrats. Italians first, he shouted to loud cheers. If Salvini has his way, his campaign to reshape Europe might have only just begun. In a rare, far-ranging interview with Time in Rome on September 4th, Salvini laid out a plan that would not just shake the EU to its foundations, but also might remake it from the inside out. Changing Europe is a big goal, he says. But I think it is at our fingertips. The Italian election in March delivered a humbling defeat to the country's traditional parties and put Salvini in the position of kingmaker. He chose to ally his far-right party, the League, with the first-place finisher anti-establishment five-star movement. The populist coalition represents a new era in this country's famously fractious politics. Salvini grabbed the powerful job of interior minister and is now responsible for Italy's policing, national security, and immigration policies. He is not Italy's head of government. That job is held by the five-star movement's Giuseppe Conte, but he doesn't need to be. The parade of foreign dignitaries lining up to meet Salvini leaves little doubt about who calls the shots. Salvini is now seen as the closest thing Italy has to a chief executive. The right-wing leader's ambitions extend far beyond his country, however, and that's what is sending jitters through Europe. Many see him as the leader most capable of piecing together a large group of populist nationalist parties in Europe, one that crosses national boundaries in the name of nationalism. On September 7th, former White House chief strategist and proto-nationalist godfather Stephen Bannon met Salvini in Rome to discuss creating a hardline coalition across Europe for crucial EU elections next May, capable of crushing the neoliberal and centrist parties that have led Brussels for decades. Bannon told Time by phone on September 8th, after meeting Salvini in Rome, that his new Brussels-based organization called The Movement aims to capture enough seats for right-wing populists in the European Parliament in next year's elections to allow them, at the very least, to block any further efforts at EU integration. He calls it command by negation. To Salvini, it's more elemental. Quote, "We are working to reestablish the European spirit that has been betrayed by those who govern this union," end of quote, he says. Slipping into the first-person pronoun, he adds, "It is clear I have to change the European dynamics." The populist wave in Europe has been building steadily over the past several years. Some believed it had crested with Britain's vote to leave the EU in June 2016. Especially after the globalist pro-EU Emmanuel Macron defeated far-right leader Marine Le Pen last year to become president of France. But Europe's right-wing nationalists have not vanished into obscurity. In Hungary, Denmark, Poland, and more, they have quietly slipped into parliaments or won significant numbers of votes. In Germany, the far-right Alternative for Germany, AfD, became the official opposition party. Now, I have to interject again here in this article by Vivienne Wald in Time magazine. I now have to go to Der Spiegel online, and I was telling you how some of the Jewish people, this is very sad to me, the Holocaust survivors are falsely equating closing out the radical Islam immigrants from Europe with them being closed out from the U.S. and other countries and being sent to places like Auschwitz and Dachau. This is so sad because they have been betrayed by the propaganda. And here's an example. This was October 5th, 2018, growing anti-Semitism in Germany. We are facing a monster. In a Der Spiegel interview, Charlotte Knobloch, 85, speaks of the fears Jews in Germany have of growing right-wing populism in the country. The former president of the Central Council of Jews in Germany is also sharply critical of U.S. Ambassador Richard Grenell. Now, here's just a little part of that interview. Der Spiegel says, "The rise of the AfD, and remember, this is the party that is against this unlimited Merkel immigration flooding the country, all the raping going on and of the girls, all of that business. The rise of the AfD is inseparably connected with the refugee policies of Chancellor Angela Merkel. Do you think it was the correct decision to not seal off the German border in September 2015? No block. And remember, there's this 85-year-old Holocaust survivor. "I view the issue through the lens of my own biography. If the U.S. immigration authorities in the late 1930s had approved the visas that my uncle applied for on behalf of my brother, his mother and me, my grandmother, would not have had to suffer such a horrific death. She was too old to be accepted into the U.S. There were similar fates people faced that I heard about at the time. That is why I was very much in favor of Germany taking in the people who were living in horrific conditions in the Budapest train station in September 2015. After all, we became a humane country after 1945. Does this poor old elderly person not hear any of the comments that radical Islam makes about the Jews, that they would like to kill them all? We really can't be like lemmings. We can't be going over a cliff. And also, when we were talking here about the mainstream press writers, and Adley, look at this historian, this eminent historian, Deborah E. Lipstadt. You have a lot of her books right down here in your bookcase, Lou, because you have a lot of World War II books, and I think I started reading one of hers. Do you remember the title of one of them?
I believe one of them was entitled Denying the Holocaust.
I believe that's correct, and it's very powerful. It's well documented, but she, too, has been taken in, and I find this really hard to understand. But, you know, we're all human. And at the end of this article, it says that she is Doreau Professor of Holocaust Studies at Emory University and author of the forthcoming Anti-Semitism Here and Now. So you see, she has a vested interest. You and I, Lou, we were just riding the rims. We talked about this several times. If we had been born to elite families, you would have probably gone to Yale. You would have probably been in the Skull and Bones. If I had not had health issues and if I had been born in that same milieu, I probably would have gone to one of those sister colleges. I would have probably gone on into Harvard. We would have been really uppity. We would have really not had anything that made us identify with the common people. There we might be spouting off all this vitriol toward Trump, making fun of the deplorables. Of course, the woman who said that, well, that was Hillary, wasn't it, who made that comment?
Oh, yes, it sure was.
She just came from, I don't want to say a redneck family, but I think her father was an auto worker. So you see, there's good and bad in everywhere and every strata of society. But you know what the Lord wants? He wants us to repent, and he wants us to pray and trust him. Well, here, talking about Deborah Lipstadt, in this article, Time, November 12th, this is still this aftershock from Pittsburgh. May their memory be a lesson. This is what she says. Now, remember, we were using our critical thinking skills a while ago on John Meacham's writings, and we were talking about this, how we can just try to find if they're just glittering generalizations with no backup, no real proof. So Deborah Lipstadt says, many American Jews worry about anti-Semitism that comes from the political left. Okay, that's right, isn't it? They see those on the left vilifying Israel in a fashion that is applied to no other country. Sometimes they see Jews denied something, denied to no other people, a national identity. Now, here we go. But the organized community has not shown the same concerns about anti-Semitism on the right. In recent decades, there has been a rise in hate groups. And some of that is true. But we also know, those of us who have studied in depth what the New World Order and Deep State are, perhaps they're the same thing, perhaps they aren't. We know that the Southern Poverty Law Center had people in there in Oklahoma at the time of the Murrah building. They had infiltrated groups. Militias are infiltrated. Patsies are developed. Maybe Sayoc is one. Maybe Nicholas Cruz was another. So that nothing is as it seems. It's like peeling an onion. The top strata is not what you just dwell on and you make your generalizations from. So, yes, there are some right-wing people, but there are some right-wing nuts who are mind-controlled. Yes, we've heard Nick Begich. He told us a lot about the CIA mind-control plans. MK Ultra, all of that. So we have to know that there are sinister forces sometimes using these scapegoats, using these patsies. But Deborah Lipstadt says, after she says about in recent decades there has been a rise in hate groups, I do not mean to suggest that the administration, and that's administration in caps, is explicitly saying their nationalism and white supremacy are acceptable. The suggestions are far from explicit. For example, there were, quote, very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville. And I believe that refers to Trump. Wasn't that one of his statements, Lou?
I think it probably was.
I think so. But Lipstadt says their vision of America is one that is white and Christian, and Jews should not deceive themselves for a moment. In these folks' eyes, Jews are neither. Now, there's where we go to a radical pronouncement without proof. These very fine people on both sides, that their vision of America is one that is white and Christian. First of all, I really resent this. If you and I had been standing there at Charlottesville, that would have been my vision, that would have been your vision, white and Christian, wouldn't it?
Sure, that's what we are.
But it says, and Jews should not deceive themselves for a moment. In these folks' eyes, Jews are neither. Neither. You see, in other words, you and I would have been labeled as Jew haters, and we're not. We're far from that. I've told you back earlier in my life, in my 20s, it was interesting. Every time I had a life crisis, practically, I could probably name maybe eight people, the people who helped me. Each person was a Jewish person. And I always thought that was rather remarkable. I came from a little town. I guess there probably was a Jewish friend going way back, but this person had emigrated back maybe in the 1800s, and he had a store, a country store there. And so his descendant was a very good friend of my father and mother, and his wife also was. And, of course, they were now Christians. They were going to our little local Methodist church. But other than that, I didn't really have any relationship or any knowledge of Jewish people. Actually, there were no African Americans in my town. It was a town of about 400 people. So, you know, it's kind of a miracle, I guess, that I didn't grow up as one of these bigots ready to, you know, go after all black people and all Jews. But, you know, I had a loving father and mother who were Christians. And my mother was college educated, and my father was partially college educated. He had to drop out. He wanted to be a doctor, but he couldn't go on and let his widowed mother just slay on a farm without any help. What we're saying here is your social status, your religion, you know, none of these things mean too much. It's what is in your heart. And the ultimate thing that should be in your heart is your love and devotion to God Almighty, to Jesus Christ. And you really then meet each day with gratitude and hope, and you trust. You give your whole life to the Lord. Now, this kind of a narrow-minded thing there, it's sad for Deborah Lipstadt, and I will say a few prayers for her, that she doesn't think all of us white Americans who are Christian hate Jewish people. Far from it. Now, we must move on. We are talking about some of these people who are going to be good role models that are going to be sort of like Trump, but in their own countries. And we've been talking about Matteo Salvini. And we were talking there about how in the other countries this populism is rising, and we said the far-right alternative for Germany, AfD, became the official opposition party. Austria's Freedom Party is now part of a coalition government. Even one of Europe's most liberal countries, Sweden, isn't immune. The far-right Sweden Democrats won a record 17.6% of votes on September 9th. In each case, the message is the same. Stronger borders, drastically fewer migrants, and a desire to take back control from the elites. These politicians are not, for now, advocating following the UK out of the EU's door. In fact, for for Europe's leaders, they are arguing for something perhaps more hazardous to integrated Europe, a radical ideological remake, including reining in open markets and open borders and snatching back control from Brussels over key decisions like public spending. If they succeed, they will remake a continent. Few voices are louder in the movement than that of Matteo Salvini. Quote, "I choose to change things from within," Salvini says. That is more difficult and longer and more complicated, but it is a more concrete solution. And a little more information out of that article from Time, September 24th, says, the driving force between the League, and now remember, the League was his new party. The League's explosive growth has been immigration, still a hot-button issue in Europe after the collapse of Syria precipitated the biggest exodus since World War II. Ahead of the March election, Salvini put it at the center of his campaign. He made the wildly impracticable promise to deport 500,000 undocumented immigrants from Italy, roughly the total that have landed on Italian shores since 2015. Now, isn't that remarkable, Lou? In 3 years, we had 500,000 people come in.
That's astounding, yes.
The message for migrants lining up on the other side of the Mediterranean, Salvini said, was La Pacia è finita. The party's over. That resonated with many Italians in the wake of the crisis. Quote, we don't have jobs for Italians, so it is difficult to give jobs to these people, says Simona Pergreffi, a League senator from Bergamo. As Italy's interior minister, Salvini now wants to suspend asylum procedures completely until the EU agrees on fair distribution of refugees, an issue that has deadlocked leaders in Brussels for years. He has incensed EU leaders by blocking NGO rescue boats from Italian ports. In August, he blocked a German-registered charity boat, the Aquarius, from disembarking 629 migrants it had rescued at sea. The vessel finally rerouted to Spain. Macron called Salvini's action, quote, nauseating. Weeks later, Salvini refused to allow 144 migrants, mostly Africans, to disembark from an Italian Coast Guard vessel in the Sicilian port of Catania. Only after a few days of furor did he allow women and children to leave the boat. And Lou, I have to ask you there, when Macron called Salvini's action nauseating to block the 629 migrants, wouldn't you rather use that word about all those radical jihadi men who raped that one defenseless girl recently in Germany?
I most surely would, yes, if it were my choice.
Salvini,
that's what I'd say.
Yes, Salvini welcomes the outrage. Under EU law, migrants are obliged to settle in the first EU country in which they land. Salvini says that is particularly unfair to Italy, the closest point in Europe to the migrant smuggling centers in strife-riven Libya. He says he regards the blockade as a major success, even though it violated international maritime law, as well as migration conventions to which Italy is a signatory. If it happens again, we will behave in exactly the same way, he says. Now, there, you see, there's that brave heart toughness, that quality that we admire in Donald Trump, that quality that we think the Lord built into him through his Scottish ancestors, through the connection of his mother, people with Christianity in Scotland. You see, God has been preparing this, just the way he put Cyrus in the Bible as a battering ram to help God's people. And I've been thinking a lot, Lou, about how we might have wished that we had regained the Republicans, both the House and the Senate. But God is wiser than we are. And if we had taken both, that might have unleashed such insanity and violence from Soros forces and the other Marxist forces that it would have put a civil war here. You see, God is allowing some of the more reasonable Democrats, some of the ones who aren't crazy, perhaps, to do some things with law and order as their underpinning. But back now to Salvini's story. Europe's battle lines are now sharply drawn. Macron and Germany's Angela Merkel on one side, Salvini and his allies on the other. We have to point out again, Merkel now is greatly weakened and will be gone. In early September, the Italian hosted Hungary's far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban in his hometown of Milan. There, Orban called Salvini his comrade in destiny, in which the two would command one of the, quote, two camps in Europe, their anti-immigration side and the liberal, global-minded one led by their nemesis, Macron. The French president returned fire. If they want to see me as their main opponent, he said, they're right to do so. And Salvini says, history will entrust us with the role of saving European values. He tells this to Time, listing among those values the Judeo-Christian roots, the right to work, the right to life. He also links migrants to crime, a charge his detractors say is a racist lie. And again, Lou, we make these statements in the MSM without any proof. Did you just imagine that those jihadist men, that one of them, I think, got a drink for this girl and took her out and raped her, and then he went in and told all his other radical jihadi colleagues to go out and pick on the defenseless girl? Did you just make that story up, Jim?
Not at all. Not at all. That's a fact. And unlike these opinions,
how do you know it was a fact? Did you go online and find an article?
I did, yes.
And it was documented. But you see here, we don't document this. His detractors, Salvini's detractors, say that there isn't any crime. Linking migrants to crime, it's a racist lie. We have to watch for these demonic words that lie themselves. Again, he brushes off the criticism. Quote, if I can reduce the number of these crimes and the presence of illegal immigrants, they can call me racist all they want. So we look now at that other figure, Viktor Orban, and we don't know whether we're going to have time to get all of this in here this evening, because there's a great deal more that we have to talk about concerning what we began to talk about on an earlier program about the Hamas connection and the Broward County deputy that had connections there with the Council on American Islamic Relations in South Florida. He's a leader there, and that's Nizar Hamzy. We have to bring some things back that are important as we look at this whole situation. But now, Time, October 1st, that was one day before your birthday, Lou.
Yes.
Hungary's Viktor Orban widens the division between EU liberals and hardliners. We'll hear a little bit again about what happened with this other comrade at arms, we shall say, in the nationalism, populism movement that is rising worldwide. Addressing Hungary's parliament on September 17th, Prime Minister Viktor Orban accused EU leaders of seeking to undermine the rights of member states to control their own borders after the EU revealed plans to create a 10,000-strong border force to tackle migration. Days later, his government launched a media campaign against the EU's pro-migration majority. His actions added to growing concerns in Europe about Orban's shift away from, and here we get one of these loaded words again, democratic norms since the migrant crisis began in 2015. This is really hilarious. Democratic norms from the viewpoint of one of those EU strongman New World Order countries, and, you know, from a leader of one of them like Macron, they would think they're having democracy. I'm beginning to think it's almost synonymous with Marxism when we hear democracy. It really looks that way, doesn't it, Lou?
It has that tendency, yeah.
Yeah. So it says, breaking rules, Orban and his nationalist Fidesz party have weakened, here it is again, democratic protections. Now, I don't think letting all these jihadis come in to a country is weakening democratic protection. See, it's how Orwellian is. It's the opposite, listeners. So since coming to power in 2010 and now effectively control all branches of government while silencing critical media. In response, EU lawmakers voted on September 12th to censure Hungary, proposing a systemic threat, that's a quote, to democracy. Here we are again. Paving the way for sanctions against a member state, Orban has said Hungary is being punished for choosing not to be a, quote, country of migrants, and believes EU leaders, quote, don't want to stop migration. They want to manage it. You know, on an individual level, we have all this stuff here now, the agenda, the militant LGBTQ advocates. We're not talking about the individuals for whom we have a lot of compassion, but this strong-arming agenda, you see, has always been bullying us while they're putting in all these school regulations that children are not to be bullied. It's a two-faced kind of thing. So the EU leaders, you see, they don't want to stop migration. They want to manage it. That's really, I believe, bullying. Building walls, but the decision was about more than just migration. In 2014, Orban set out his vision of illiberal democracy. That's a quote. A strong state with high levels of social discipline and limited public dissent. This presents a dilemma to the EU's centrist lawmakers. Orban's illiberal platform is wildly popular domestically. He triumphed in free elections in April after running on an anti-migrant platform. He closed Hungary's southern border at the height of the migrant crisis and cast himself as a defender of Christian values. Lou, which country would you rather live in today, France or Hungary?
Much rather live in Hungary.
Any country that is trying to come under Christian values and keep the culture, the story of Christmas is coming soon. The birth of our Lord and Savior who came to earth to die on the cross for us. Oh, yes. These countries who remember God, remember Jesus, will be blessed. We know that's true. But the article concludes, there's a growing divide. The EU's leaders are increasingly split between integrationists like Macron and anti-migration populists like Orban and Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Salvini. Although the border force, now remember, this article said the EU revealed they were going to create a 10,000-strong border force to tackle migration. Although the border force was intended as an olive branch to the hardliners, Orban's response marked his bluntest rejection yet of the EU. Now, we'd have to think this looks like a token kind of gesture, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
10,000?
10,000 was nothing when you consider the length of all these borders of these European
countries. And remember, we said in 2015, since 2015, 500,000 have come in there to Italy.
Yeah, exactly.
So how can 10,000 handle 500,000?
They can't, pure and simple.
They really can't, can they? So as if to show he has options, and this is Orban, he met the day after his speech with another regional power broker, Russian President Vladimir Putin. And again, we can't endorse everything about Putin, but at least Christianity is being extolled there. And we hope that these past things, if there were assassinations of people in other countries, we hope that will stop and that Russia will really become a real light. We love seeing those Russian skaters. You know how you and I love those figure skaters in one of the prior Olympics. Right before all this vitriol and the Mueller so-called investigation came into being, we should be friends with countries who are Christian. We have a lot more to say, and we'll have to pick up this story again next week. So we do hope you will tune in again to WWCR 4.840 megahertz Thursday evenings, 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Saturday morning, 7.490 megahertz, 8 a.m. And you will go to lwrn.net and hear us on Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. God bless you, and let's give thanks to the Lord. He has been good to us today, yesterday too. Good night.